Okay, I was just, if you end up really hating this talk, particularly if you're a physicist, you're in actually quite good company. So what I'm going to talk about today is this paper just appeared in Science. They've never published anything like this before, and probably we never will again. And it took forever and so on. So I was going to tell you a little bit about this. So, I want to start with the paper, try to give some context. But I'm going to assume you're going to go read it. Right. So I want to get this issue of architecture because this KITP meeting is about architecture. And what I want to get to is the architecture of the microbial cells. And there's a particular bacteria. So the bacterial biosphere has a very elegant architecture. We understand a lot about it. I've got way too many slides. This is being recorded and the slides will be online. So I put a lot of extra slides in that would be suitable to read but wouldn't be suitable for the talk. So I'll kind of fly through some of those. And like I said, if I was smarter, this would be a lot better. And this whole thing needs help. So if you were here last Monday, we talked about the fact that both in our cells and our technologies, we would like to avoid these things. And so this paper was kind of the departure point for last week, which I won't do much of this week. Another point of departure. Again, this will all be online, so if you want to look these up, you don't have to write them down or anything now. So collapsing a lot of dimensions into a 2D plot so you can put it up here. We want to build systems that are robust and efficient. And you usually get one or the other. And again, we're obviously, this is wasteful on so many dimensions that I probably can't even list them. And often we build systems that aren't either, and so there's a gap here, and we want to work on that gap. So we have theory, and it's quite deep, but it's also quite fragmented, and we want to try to get a more unified theory. So basically what each theory does is kind of attack one dimension of a multidimensional problem, but most of the interesting trade-offs are across dimensions. So I'm going to look at this one and try to look at a sharpening hard bounds. And then case studies, in this case, the case study is from biology. And another thing we could do is find and fix bugs. That's mostly what engineers do, is find, fix bugs without really knowing what the achievable performance is, because right now most of our systems are so bad that we can improve them a lot without knowing what perfection is. So it's like if your steam engine is 1% efficient, you can improve it without knowing what 100% is. So I'm going to talk about this theory plus biology case study. So it turns out this is an ideal case study in many respects. I won't be able to say all of them. It's a long-standing mystery why cells oscillate in this way. I would use the word universal, but I mean it in the most ordinary possible sense. I don't mean it in any deep sense. I just mean very, very, very common. So I'm going to stop saying universal because people get all worked up. And I'm just going to say very, very, very common. This problem is great because the components are really well known. It's the most well-studied circuit and the most common circuit on the planet. And there's 10 to the 30th copies or so. Extremely experimentally accessible. NADH is going to be the signal, and it naturally fluoresces. So you don't have to do anything to the cells except shine lasers on them. Problem is, of course, they get a little sick when you do that. We're going to look at it from the point of view of combining evolution physiology and sort of CDS tools. I think it's broadly relevant. And like I said, extreme responses are typical, but positive as well as negative. And again, what reviewers have said. So we're talking about glycolytic oscillations. And the trade-offs are between disturbance rejection, fragilities, and metabolic overhead, both the amount of enzymes and the complexity of enzymes. And I'm not going to do much of a tutorial on that, but I'll try to say a few things about it. Like I said, most ubiquitous circuit. And the community that studies this is very solid, so you don't have to do a whole lot of just basic scientific hygiene to get started on the subject. You know, you don't have to do a lot of shoveling of crap. Really solid. All they're missing is a theorem, which is really nice. Perfect, right? They're just missing a theorem. And so you don't have to worry about a lot of stuff. Of course, you have to do a few new experiments to show that your theorem's right and stuff. But so here's a typical experiment. What you see is these beautiful bifurcations, and these are oscillations. What they're oscillations in is NADH fluorescence, and this is in yeast. And you get pictures like this. It's not hard to get simulations to do this. The model that I'm going to talk about actually does this. And you can get models anywhere from 2 states to 500 states that will reproduce this behavior. So again, it's a nice problem because there's simulation models that are extremely good, that are like the experiments. And so the question is, why? Okay? And this is we could spend all of our hour talking about what I mean by why here. I'm just going to do it, and hopefully it'll be clear. But the point is, the kind of answer we're going to get here is not the kind of answer that the scientific community has generally lost interest in the kind of answer that I'm going to give. And my hope is that this work will encourage the scientific community to be interested in these kinds of questions. It is very much the kind of question that either a mathematician would ask or an engineer would ask, but not a scientist. And so, or a doctor would ask, but the scientific community has not been interested in these kind of questions. So what I'm going to try to do is tell you what an answer would be. And so the nice thing about this as a case study is, in some sense, it's really easy. Like I said, all you have to do is math. You have to understand the domain questions, but you just have to do math. And so I talked about last Monday was turbulence is another good example of that, where a lot of the mysteries can come out of mathematically studying Navier-Stokes equations. So I like problems like this. Neuroscience could not be worse. It's just god-awful hard. There isn't a simulator of the brain. There's not Navier-Stokes equations for the brain. So most of neuroscience is not math problems. But what I'm going to try to say is some things that I hope will be maybe hopeful anyway. So this is a picture we want to get to, is that there really is a hard trade-off between basically an enzyme amount or metabolic overhead and fragility in a way that we can quantify with a theorem. And so this is where we're going to try to get. What we talked about last time is that there are these sort of universal metabolic systems. In us, we have this sort of huge variety of things, but we're omnivores. We can eat damn near anything. We produce a lot of different things from our food, but we have in our blood a few of these basic building blocks. So we're going to, and I'm not going to review this again, we're going to look at this at the cellular level. So we're going to zoom inside in every cell. What you have is catabolic processes. You have precursors and carriers. I'll say a little bit about what those are. And then those fan out into the biosynthetic pathways. And so this is inside every cell. And we're going to go right in the middle of that bow tie. So this is sort of, not only is it's in every cell on the planet, but it's at the heart of every cell on the planet is the circuit we're going to be studying. So if you've seen this kind of diagram, this picture I'm making is just a gross cartoon picture of it. Okay, so let's zoom in a little bit. So we're going to fill in this in a way, sort of we're going to draw a diagram that's kind of typical of how a biologist might draw this. So these are the precursors. These are all various forms of mostly phosphorylated sugars. Okay, they're called precursors because they're the starting point for all the biosynthetic pathways. We'll come back to that later if we have some time. I hope we'll have some time to do that. These arrows are enzymatically catalyzed reactions. So each one of those has an enzyme. Again, we'll want to try to come back and try to understand that a bit. What's important is autocatalysis. One of the most important things that this circuit produces is ATP for the rest of the cell. So most of the ATP it produces goes to the rest of the cell. Some of it, though, is fed back. So it uses ATP at the front end and then gets it back at the end. Now, it makes more than it. The arrows don't indicate that. You use 2 up front and you make 4 in the back, and the reason is because at some point in here what I'm not showing is a split where you get the sugar split into 2, so you're getting double down here. Otherwise, it wouldn't sustain itself if it didn't make more than it consumed. Okay. This is a kind of feedback, but it's a positive feedback and it's destabilizing. And it's in everything we build. It's all over in the cell. We'll look at other cases in a minute. There's also control feedbacks. And I'm actually not drawing all of them. I'm just drawing a few of them. And this is actually kind of a cartoon. I'm not sure how careful I was and where everything goes. The metabolites are right, but all these arrows might not be quite right. So I apologize on that. This is standard, though, so. And that's this part of that diagram. And so you can see everything just flowing off of it. And that's why they're called precursors. Now, notice that we don't have the feedbacks in that picture. Because if you did, it would just be black with lines. This is a familiar story, which is that We always say, no matter what biology starts out, you have some source and some receiver. It could be signaling, gene expression, metabolism, even lineages. And then you get, after a while, you get tons of feedback. But I'm interested in the interplay between control and the feedback of energy and materials. That's the really heart of this story. So these are all these feedbacks, okay. So the point is, we're going to grossly simplify this picture. So the question is, what's the simplest autocatalytic process that we can study that's a toy version of this? And again, fortunately, this has been studied to death. So the kind of model I'm going to be using is absolutely standard. So we don't have to invent anything here. We can sort of pool the metabolites together, and we're going to lump them all together, and we're going to end up with this incredibly simple system with just two metabolites. One of them is intended to be all the sugars between that first reaction up there and the last one down there. And this is ATP. And we've got autocatalytic loops. We've got the rest of the cell. And we've got just two reactions. Okay, really three reactions if you think of the rest of the cell as a reaction. You cannot come up with anything simpler. And oh, by the way, for the theorem we're going to produce, in engineering, we do not have as simple an example as this. This is the simplest example. And so for teaching the stuff, I think it's actually quite nice. Okay. We're going to assume mass action most of the time. So one thing that's a problem with these slides is sometimes Q is equal to A and sometimes it isn't. I'll get around to what those are. The difference is, if you know what I'm talking about, this is the stoichiometry and this is the rates. And if it's mass action, A is equal to Q, but it need not be. But typically A and Q are both going to be 1. And that's in this picture. But I'm going to go through this model a little bit and try to... So the first simplest thing is we've got a differential equation. X and Y are our variables. X is our intermediate. Y is our product. Okay, and this is a process that consumes the product. It's a disturbance. So I'm assuming this is linearized around some nominal operating point, and the paper goes into the nonlinear models and so on. It turns out all the simulations are going to be nonlinear because I want limit cycles. I don't want growing exponentials, and all of the oscillations are limit cycles, and so I'm going to be cavalier about that. So this process is the rest of the cell. We're just assuming it's a constant consumption, but that D is going to fluctuate as the demand in the rest of the cell goes. So what it does is notice that it consumes Y, doesn't have any effect on X. Now, if we're doing biosynthesis, of course, X is also consumed by the rest of it, but we're going to focus on energy. Okay, so that's that. The first box, notice that the 1 and the minus A, it says that we make 1X. We consume A copies of Y, that's what the vector is, and we do it at that rate. So A minus H is the autocatalytic feedback, which is positive, minus H, which is the negative feedback, times Y. Okay? Again, linearized system. So the net feedback is A minus H. And A will always be, the problem is sometimes I'm going to put Q in the stoichiometry, and sometimes I'm not, and I apologize for that. In the paper, they're separate. So that's that reaction. And then finally, here's the payback. You consume an X, that minus 1 is a consuming an X. You make 1 plus AY. So we've normalized this to say we're always going to produce 1 Y, but we can dial in the amount of autocatalysis necessary to get that. Again, for the case we're interested in, A is 1, but we can make A 0 and get rid of all the autocatalysis to see what happens in the network if you don't need autocatalysis. And then what we have is we have kx minus gy. Kx is a constant times the amount of x. And so think of k as depending on the enzyme levels in this reaction. And then gy is a little feedback loop from y that's actually on this other enzyme. So we have two possible feedbacks. And in the typical simple models, this g is neglected. It's thought to be redundant or not important, and so it's usually not put in the models because you don't need it to get oscillations. That's going to be an important point. Okay. Yeah? X is a bunch of intermediate sugars all lumped together. All these intermediate, remember I had all these sugars? Imagine that we're just going to think of them as a pool, and it turns out they oscillate together. So the technical reason we think we can get away with this is it's hot bifurcation. There's two pools, and these are the two pools. Notice that I don't even have NADH in the model, and NADH is going to be the thing we're going to be looking at. But yeah. I'm sorry? No, NADH is not even in the model. It happens to oscillate out of phase with ATP, so we can use it as a signature, yeah. So this is a grossly oversimplified model. Yeah, and so, and the good news is all the analysis that I'm going to do, you can do on any of the more complex models and you get the same answer. Yeah, so I'll get to this, but bigger H, which is more control feedback, and bigger G requires more complex enzymes. So you pay a price for high gain control because you have to have a more complex enzyme. So that's one of the problems with doing control out in sort of in the real world is you don't get to just have somebody else worry about the actuators and sensors. K, yeah, yeah. It's both, actually. Yeah, it's both. Yeah. It's DDT. This is a differential equation. Well, they will, and those will depend on these all these numbers. What you're asking is we've eliminated enzymatic intermediates, but those are so fast that we don't need to worry about that. The big thing we've eliminated is all these intermediate paths. So we've collapsed everything into a few reactions. But doing this is fairly standard for this model to try to explain the oscillation. So none of this is, there's no, it's actually, this is an important point. There's absolutely no innovations whatsoever in any piece of the story. It's because the point is we don't want anything to be controversial because the end is bad enough. So each piece that I'm going along is off the shelf, off the shelf, off the shelf. And this is sort of off the shelf. I'm just trying to sort of tell you where these numbers come from, because we're going to come back to this issue of complexity amount. So if you make your enzymes more complicated, they're more expensive to build. If you make more of them, they're more expensive to build. So I'm going to be a little cavalier about the fact that if you make any of those numbers bigger, it's metabolically more expensive. Except for Q or A. The idea is that if you got rid of the autocatalysis, you'd be much less efficient. And that's a bit of phenomenology we're going to take the biochemist's word for. Okay. So we have two controls, H and G, that appear here in the equations. We have enzyme levels appearing in K, and we have autocatalysis appearing through A. Those are our parameters. Okay. So I put Q back in up here. Here's our A matrix. So it's, you know, you can do the obvious thing. You can say, what's the steady state disturbance response? Easy to compute. That is, if I change D a little bit, well, it's a linear system, so I change it a lot, but imagine a little bit. How much does Y change? And it's easy to compute. It's 1 over H minus A. It's 1 over the net feedback. Okay. We can also easily get stability. And to be stable, you need to have H minus A positive. If you don't, the system crashes. You also have to have it less than this quantity. And if you don't, you oscillate, and that's a Hopf bifurcation. Okay. So we can put these two things together. And we get our first hard limit, that there's a lower bound on how good the disturbance rejection can be set by stability. Okay. So that's, and notice that getting to this point is almost trivial. Right? I mean, this is all the most trivial you could do. Okay. So we can play around with this. We can look at what disturbance attenuation. So here we're going to stick a disturbance in, a unit disturbance. Ideally, we'd like the concentration of Y to not drop at all. The cell is depending on ATP concentrations being held constant. So this droop is bad. Okay. So you want to crank the gain up. As you crank the gain up, you get a better steady state response. We don't have any problem here with stability because we have no autocatalysis. So if you didn't have autocatalysis, this would not oscillate. So one of the insights that was very early discovered was that the autocatalysis and the regulation, high gain regulation, are necessary in order to have oscillations or longer pathways. Okay. So let's throw in some autocatalysis. Now you get this bound because G is zero, very simple, K over Q. So notice that Q big is bad. Q is the amount of autocatalysis. K big is good. K is a lot of enzyme. Okay. So in this case, when you crank up H2, 3, or 4, 2, 3, and 4 are biologically plausible numbers. You get oscillations. And the classical story is this is the pattern responsible for oscillations, and that's true. That's correct. It's the combination of autocatalysis, and then because you want to maintain very tight concentrations, you crank that gain up and you oscillate. Okay? That's the standard story. Yeah. So you're producing ATP here. You're consuming it here. From the stoichiometry, you're making one more copy of it than you're consuming. So the net there's a net production of ATP to the rest of the cell. But now you're saying A is one. So for every one I produce, I consume one. So I produce two, consume one, take the rest of the cell. Each reaction. Okay, does that make sense? Okay. So you're, okay, this enzyme has ATP as a substrate. And so the more ATP, the faster it goes. That's actually produces, we'll get to this, it produces a right half plane zero antipole. But then this thing inhibits it. Okay. So I have a long kind of, I have a bunch of slides that we could go into about how that all works, but it's standard. Well, the two things. The enzyme has two docking sites for ATP. And actually, it's ATP and AMP, but we're going to ignore that for a second. So imagine it has one site that's catalytic. So it takes ATP, it takes glucose, it takes a phosphate off ATP, sticks it on glucose, gives off ADP. But then on the back, there's a knob. Think of this as a machine running, and there's a knob, and that's where ATP comes up, and if there's a lot of ATP, it slows it down, right? Okay? Because if you don't do that, the whole system just crashes. It's unstable. It's one enzyme that does all this. Phosphofructokinase. So phosphofructokinase, PFK, is at the heart of the oscillator. Okay? That's the standard story. Okay. So you get more ringy if you set H equals K equals 3 and go from not catalytic to catalytic, it gets ringier. Okay. So you can sort of see the trade-offs in this picture. And I think I have a picture of it. Okay, so this is going to all be in the slides. And so that's obviously too busy for you to look at now. But you know, if you're looking at the PDF file, this is actually a good thing to try to trace through. So, okay. But there's a big difference between G equals 1 and G equals 0. Big difference. Okay. G equals 1, you crank the gain up and it gets a little ringy. G equals 0, you crank the gain up and it goes wacko. Right? Okay, so the next punchline is... So I can plot two plots. Here is my steady state versus K necessary for stability. So this is the stability boundary. This has to be bigger than this, so I can plot that stability boundary for G equals 0, G equals 1. There's a huge difference here, right? There's a huge difference here. And why does this matter? Okay, that's this picture. So let me just make sure you understand this picture. What I'm plotting, this is my fragility, which is, I want that to be really small, but I can't get it small because of this boundary. So that's my measure of fragility. If that's big, it's bad. Okay? This is my metabolic overhead, K. So I'm willing to use a lot of enzyme. I can be quite robust. But the problem is, This is the amount of enzyme per cell. Orders of magnitude variability from cell to cell. Okay. So that G equals zero is implausibly fragile. No way a cell is going to work that way. Okay? Sure, it'll oscillate, but that's not the issue. The issue is it even plausible? And the answer is no. That G really does matter, and you go and look in the literature and look at bigger models, and G equals 1 is much more plausible than G equals 0. Okay. And you go back and you ask everybody, and they go, oh, yeah, maybe that loop really matters, right? Once you pull film. So if you explain this to the experts, they go, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Oh, now I understand that. Okay. So I want the other thing, just this, I'm not going to be able to really go into this kind of detail. I think this part of the paper actually is easy to read. So notice that the distribution is narrower when you're running on glucose than ethanol. Okay. So what we're going to do in our experiments, we're going to try to find a worst case experiment. What you do is you run aerobic and ethanol, and actually glycolysis is running in reverse. So you're eating ethanol, and then you're actually running glycolysis in reverse to store glycogen. And then you give it glucose, but you dump cyanide on it. And this is you know, torturing the poor cells. But that makes it switch. Now, if you don't give it glucose and you put cyanide on it, you just kill it because it can't eat ethanol without oxygen. But it can run glycolysis without oxygen. In fact, our model assumes there is no oxygen. So our model is only this post cyanide model. So we're going to dump glucose on. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to get it over into this regime where it doesn't have many enzymes because it's not actually using this enzyme. And then you trick it into saying, ah, oh, you don't need this enzyme, zap it with cyanide and glucose, and then all of a sudden it needs this enzyme. But it better be robust over orders of magnitude, and there's just no way this guy is, unless you massively overproduce. So going from G equals 0 to G equals 1 is a huge win. It's absolutely essential, and it looks like that's the way the cell does it. Okay. So if you go out and actually do this to cells, torture them like this, you get this ringiness. So you don't see these sustained oscillations. Then the question is, again, this is, I think, explained well in the cell, but there's a big literature you have to read, is individual isolated yeast cells do not oscillate. No one's ever seen them oscillate. Big mystery. And the reason is intact cells can control their environment enough that they'll never oscillate. Well, how did I show you those experimental oscillations? Those were extracts. You take a bunch of cells and you mush them up and you put them in a test tube, and then now you can control everything and you can get it to oscillate. So you can take it right through the hop bifurcation. The cells on their own don't do that, and they've never been seen to do that. And the reason is the cells are robust. So this network has the potential to oscillate, but under natural circumstances it never will. Because it's well designed, it stays away from that. It'll die before it oscillates. Okay. So G equals zero is implausibly fragile. Okay, so that's punchline one. Okay. So that gets the experts interested because this is new. This is a new explanation of what's going on, and now they can go back and play around with stuff. For me, this is only the conjecture phase, really. Okay, what do we need to do next? We need to worry about, do we need autocatalysis? That's a phenomenological argument from the biochemists. For the time being, I'm going to take them at their word. They claim that there's no way, if you get rid of this autocatalysis, you could not build this network. Okay, you cannot build this network without the autocatalytic feedback. So, and that's pretty much true of everything we build. So if you have a power plant, you need power to like pulverize the coal and run everything. You can't run it just without recirculating. So it's plausible. What's less plausible is that I've got this phenomenological model for all the enzymes. Are there alternatives that don't face these trade-offs? Can we somehow beat this trade-off, something clever, with signaling and phosphorylation cascades and something fancy? And perhaps more importantly, does this analysis go through for more realistic models? Okay. So I want to kind of do the last two a little bit together. And the realistic models part is actually the easy part. You just put in, you know, you put in more realistic models, and as you do, the story doesn't really change. So here's the question. What if the control implementation is allowed arbitrarily complex dynamics? That's an interesting question now, right? Is this necessary? Is this trade-off necessary, or is it some accident of evolution? So now we're going to start doing these block diagrams. By the way, one thing I realized controls people don't tell that these wires are not physical wires. When we draw a block diagram, like actually even this, how does this happen, right? This happens because on the purple line, Y actually does dock with the enzyme. The red line, it docks with the enzyme in a different place. What does this mean? Those arrows don't mean anything. They're just writing a picture that describes the equations. Now you can just do the algebra. It's a second order system, right? You can do it all. You can compute the denominator polynomial. It's got a right half plane zero. I think that's the most interesting thing. And now you can do, you could say, well, what do I care about? I care about the dynamics from delta to y. What we looked at before was steady state delta to y and oscillations. Now I want to look at the entire dynamic response of delta to y. Delta being, well, I've changed, I'm sorry. Delta is the perturbation in D. I've got slides from different talks all stuck together here. I apologize. But all I'm saying is this is the same thing we had before. We're going to perturb it just like we did before. We're going to kick it. But now we really want to look at the whole dynamic response. Now, the simulations, we were looking at the whole dynamic response. Okay. So the idea is that W doesn't depend on H, and S does depend on H. And we're interested in the product WS, which is the response of y to delta. But we can split it up into these two parts. And there's a theorem that says the integral log of the sensitivity function is greater or equal to zero. You've heard us if you're in the neuroscience stuff, we've talked about this a little bit. If you're a controls person, you've seen this, you know, as undergrads. So I'm not going to explain this. What I want to do is try to connect this with this problem. Okay, so if we go back to this is our simple case. This is the case where this holds. This is this integral, and we just plotted it for these simulations. So now we can see what happens is, what does this mean? It means those areas are equal. That's all. Okay, log linear plot, frequency equal areas. Okay, and you can have this inequality be really big, and that's gratuitously fragile. And that's what you'll do if you do bad designs. Okay. If you have it with equality, you're robust, but your robustness is fragile in the sense that you pay for this part with this part. Okay. Oh, shit. Yeah.
So delta was the
change in ATP load around some linearization. At some frequency, it no longer becomes important. So you really care. You're exactly right. You're interested primarily in this low frequency region, right? You can have some ringiness. So it's a usual sort of thing where you want the sensitivity to be small at low frequencies, and you just don't want it to blow up at big frequencies. That's right. Exactly. So you get this little bit. So robustness is I crank H up. I get more robust. Notice that my DC is better, my low frequency performance is better, and I pay for it with a little bit of ringiness. Okay? A little bit here. Okay. A little bit of fragility. Now, we go to this case, and the point is, you can see right away that this is completely crazy fragile, too fragile. And you can see that with the extended version of this, you get a zero and a pole. The zero and pole are very close to each other. We'll do this demo in a minute. And it's all you can calculate everything. The nice thing about this is you can calculate everything analytically, and you can look at all this. Large K is good, large A is bad, G equals zero is implausibly fragile. Put G equals one in here, a lot better. Still a tough trade-off, a little more ringy. But now this picture really tells you, in some sense, exactly what's going on. As I push this down, it pops up. But I've got this extra start. I've got this extra to pay for. It's not bigger than equals zero. It's bigger than some number that's not zero. And that's unavoidable. This autocatalysis makes that unavoidable. And so not only do you put that feedback loop in, but you put that one in as well. And this one is absolutely essential for robustness, not for minimal functionality and not to get oscillations. Yeah. Both of them are. Anytime you have an allosteric regulator, the way it works is it's a non-catalytic binding that changes the allosteric, means changing the conformation of the protein, that changes the rate at which it does autocatalysis. And this is also doubly expensive, because not only do we build a big complex enzyme with all these sites that are to control it, but then we have to actually make a lot more, because we're always going to be tuning it off of optimal. So it's like you fill up your factory floor with these very complicated machines, and then you run them half on or close to half on so that you can throttle them. So it's very expensive to do this, but the cell does it because it's necessary. It pays the price. Yeah, they're both negative feedbacks. No, they're different enzymes. Yeah, different enzymes. This would be like, the problem is we've so abstracted this. This would be like phosphofructokinase, and this is pyruvate kinase. Well, they're both, well, we could go back to the diagram. I mean, the problem is, this is a very abstracted model. So this is sort of think of these as a lumped bunch of enzymes and a lumped bunch of metabolites. There is an enzyme called phosphofructokinase that has the features of this enzyme, in the sense that it has a catalytic site for a sugar, which it phosphorylates with the phosphate it takes off of ATP. That takes ADP as a substrate, which isn't in the model. And grabs that phosphate back and sticks it on it and produces pyruvate. Okay. So we've got two pictures here. They're both similar in that there's a fragility versus metabolic overhead, but this is much deeper, okay, I'm claiming, because this says this trade-off holds no matter how complex this controller is. Okay. Now I've just parameterized by this. It turns out this is all local, so this is kind of a, this has ATP and ATP as a substrate, so this is a much more local controller. But the idea is that up above is all phenomenology, right? This is actually, this dimension is really quite rigorous, and it only depends on the poles and zeros. It doesn't depend on the dimension, the complexity, or anything else. Okay. And the insight is that it also really talks about the entire dynamic response, whereas up here is just DC versus stability, right? So the first case is easier to understand, much easier to explain, and it kind of warms you up for the real thing, okay? Okay. Oh, no, that's the whole point of this. That's crucial punchline. For this, I'm allowing that H could be replaced by an arbitrarily complex. That's an important punchline. That's what I'm saying. It's much more rigorous. And the point is, the paper belabors this point, right? So I'm kind of not belaboring things that the paper does a good job of belaboring. What the paper doesn't do, paper assumes you know all the biochemistry, right? So I'm trying to say a little bit about the structure of the models and stuff, but it belabors this point, the difference between these two. And it's really important, because it says that this isn't an accident of evolution. If you have the structure, and now we're still accepting the autocatalysis is necessary, then you could put complex phosphorylation cascades, all sorts of stuff in there, and it would not change this trade-off. So it's doing well. It's in some sense optimal, but it's optimally robust. So this is what we think. So these are numbers that are plausible. And so you're varying K, and you get a little bit of ringiness, but you don't get a little bit of ringiness that we see. That little bit of ringiness is the sort of ringiness we actually see. and can make happen. And so here's the idea, is you got these hard limits, and so it's really a three-dimensional picture. You have fragility, metabolic overhead, simple enzymes, complex enzymes, or complex networks. And there's this hard trade-off. So I'm not going to go through this, but what's cute about this is that there's a direct analogy. And I just want to emphasize one point. Again, this is in the supplement of the PNAS paper, but the idea is that actually this is more complicated because it's got four states, right? So it's actually more complicated. The cool thing about this is that So I start out being able to stabilize it like this. If I go shorter, it gets harder and harder. So I get shorter, it gets really hard, and eventually it becomes impossible. And it's impossible, okay? And the point is, it's so fragile that I can't do it. But what's really interesting is that, but we know why that happens. It's getting more and more unstable. The pole is moving off the left half plane, and it's getting harder for that reason. But this is in some sense more interesting. If I stop looking at the tip but start moving my gaze down to the middle, it also becomes impossible. And all that's moving there is the zero. Okay. And the fact that this could, we never teach this very well. I think it's finally we can start making sense of this. But biology is going to go to a lot of trouble to get this kind of remote sensing that makes it possible to do this, right? So zeros are important, as important as the pole. So you can go through, and there's a nice translation, and again, these slides will be up there so you can have a look at it. Yeah, so this idea is you lower your focus, you go from this robust situation up. And of course, if it's down, it's easy, right? No problem. No instability. A modest instability, but a good sensor. The tough instability, or just not a good enough sensor. So Paul promised me he'd be able to do that by now, but you're doing good on the, you're kicking my ass on the bike, so that's good. Okay, well, we'll see. Yeah, that could be. That's possible. So the point is, enzyme levels moves you along here, but this trade-off isn't very severe, right? You're getting a little more fragility as the enzyme level's dropping. You'll get a little ringy, but you wouldn't expect the cell to have any big problems. So what's interesting is the cell is putting a lot of complexity, a lot of metabolic overhead in these complex enzymes to make it robust. And that's, I think, I would say universal property of complex systems, but it's just very, 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 very common. So good architectures give you not only the ability to hug up against the conservation laws, which we're doing, it's optimal in the sense of it's as good as it can be subject to that, but it also gives you alternatives along there, and we still don't have a good framework for thinking about that as much as we could. Okay, so one thing we'd like to do is this, make this side as rigorous as that side. And so this, we got to fix all this stuff, which is a mess. This is a first cut. Let me say a little bit about this, switching to discrete time, because I wanted to tell Dimitri about Bodhi Shannon. Run through this really quick. I just want you to get the picture, and we'll talk about it more later. So that's the picture. So I want to just interpret this. So the benefits are, I'm going to call this the minus part. This part has to be balanced by the plus part. Okay? I've just taken out and pulled out the minus part of the integral and the plus part of the integral. But then there's an extra part you pay, which is the instability. So that's the cost of control. That's the cost of stabilization. Okay? Now, what's the cost of remote control? Here's the Shannon story, right? That. What's remarkable, even in retrospect, is that that's Shannon channel capacity of a channel in the loop. So it's very elegant. And what's amazing about this is, well, there's a lot of historical amazing things about this, but Nuno Martins really is the guy that pioneered this work, but a lot of people have contributed to this. So the reason I put Nuno Martins up there is if you really want to read more about this, you got to go to Nuno Martins' website. Now notice that these are two independent constraints on this, on the benefits of feedback. What if we have a remote sensor running over a channel? Once again, remarkably, channel capacity shows up. You get a benefit. The problem is we don't know how to code to get all this benefit in general. Benefit of remote sensing, okay? So that's a pretty elegant combination of information and control theory. And it basically recovers all of information theory if you just get rid of all the feedbacks. So let me just try to give you a little picture of this. Here's Shannon. Here's Bodhi. Hard bounds, achievable under some assumptions, solution decomposable. These are all features of this that we like. So if you've had these courses, you know about this. So what's Shannon do, right? I've got two delays. This is a little funny way to write this, but I've got two delays here. I've got a delay of the disturbance arriving. So it's a remote disturbance. It takes a while to get to me. I have a remote sensor. It takes a while for that sensor to get to me, okay? And entropy difference. And the idea is that as the delta D delay goes to infinity, and if the entropy rate is below C, we can make zero errors. That's the standard picture. Okay. And you, if you know information theory, you know all this. Kind of a non-standard way of doing this. How do we combine these? Well, we do it through the miracle of PowerPoint. So it's easy to pose the problem, right? But the interesting thing was that picture. What's surprising is you just stick the two things together. What changes, I mean, it really does look too good to be true, right? What changes is the cost of stabilization, the benefits of remote sensing, but the need for low latency. Right. So the point is these delays have to be less than that delay or you don't get any benefits in control. Now the problem is if those delays are close to each other, you're going to get less benefit. And that gets to be rate distortion-like, and even in the information theory case, that's a murky subject. Okay. So that's the Bodhi Shannon story. Yeah. Okay, here's the intuition. Somebody's throwing something at me that I want to dodge. The information about where it's going had better get to me before the bullet gets there. Okay. So delta D better be a lot longer, ideally a lot longer, than delta R plus delta U. Haven't worried about that. That's another trade-off. Yes. That's a very interesting point. If delta D is too long, you might have forgotten. That's a great point. That's a great point. That's not in this model. That's another dimension of this problem. This is now you're getting into Turing world, right? So that's a really great point. That's a very interesting insight. Yeah. Great point. This does not consider computation at all. Okay? None of these boxes, all these boxes are assumed to have arbitrary amounts of computation in this picture. Okay. Okay, so autocatalytic and control feedbacks, complex versus dynamics. So what I want to do is I'm gonna see what I can get through here. I want to talk about architecture. And the idea is I want to talk about architecture, and I don't want to lose the dynamics. There's real dynamics in these networks, and I don't want to throw them away because I start. These little circuits have dynamics. We just looked at rich dynamics, right? And we don't want to throw those dynamics away. And we had this crazy idea that we had heard this afternoon that we should, when we study networks, we should actually study the dynamics that are from those networks. Blew me away. So in the spirit of this talk this afternoon, I'm going to try to see if we can do that. Okay? So I'm going to start drawing big networks, but I want you to remember, it's still metabolism. Okay? Okay, cool. So let's zoom back out, right? Let's go back out. The bacterial cell has this incredible variety in which the same architecture must work, right? Okay, I'm going to skip this. You can go through this on the slides. What happens is we're making building blocks. And there's a rich layered structure which I... We have to do this another day because I want to get to another point. What there is two big macro layers. I want to make this... And then you can look at the slides. The idea is that the building blocks, amino acids and ribonucleotides, come down here, and they are processed by these polymerases, and they have to make the enzymes. What is this? This is autocatalysis, right? Exactly the same sort of dynamic process we saw before. But now it's at the level of the whole cell. Biology is full of this. Everywhere we go, we see layering, and we see autocatalysis. Lots of collectively cell ribosomes make ribosomes. When a bacterial cell is growing on optimal medium, it's mostly making ribosomes so it can make more ribosomes, literally. Most of protein biosynthesis is being made to make the protein components of ribosomes, which are being made to make more ribosomes. Okay, but what I want to talk a little bit about is We talked about this yesterday. What's the right mathematical object to look at? And so what I want to rewrite my equations like this. And I'm going to stick all the constant stuff into a matrix and all the dynamic stuff into a vector. And I have ddt of a vector is stoichiometry times this. Okay, that's a stoichiometry matrix. So we have mass and energy on the left-hand side. Mass and energy balance, reaction fluxes. Dynamics. Dynamics, 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 dynamics. Dynamics, dynamics, dynamics. Matrix of integers. Symbol can be known exactly, amenable to high throughput assays and manipulation. So we know the stoichiometry matrices for bacteria that we can't even culture because we have their genomes because we scooped it out of the sea. Bowtie architecture. You cannot find a more mathematically attractive object than this. It's much nicer than the reaction flux, unfortunately, is a mess. Difficult to determine, manipulate, affected by stochastics, all sorts of spatial mechanical structure. It does have an hourglass structure, and it can be lots of modeling of optimal control. So there's stuff you can do with it. Okay. But I want to focus on this a little bit. Okay. I'm going to skip this. Okay. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this glycolysis and act at one pathway, which is amino acid biosynthesis. We're choosing H. pylori for a very specific reason. And quick, anybody guess what that reason is? It's an obligate gut parasite. So it doesn't have to make the enzymes that are needed by us. So it doesn't make very many amino acids. So it only makes a few amino acids, so I can put the whole thing on one slide. So H. pylori is chosen so that I can make a picture that I can show you, and you can almost see the details. So so what's this picture? These are bipartite graphs. So what I've got is reaction 1 takes substrate 1 to substrate 2 and uses ADP or ATP. And of course, this isn't really right. I mean, it's not right, right? You really want this, and it's in, but you can sort of think of it as this cartoon, but it's sort of a bipartite graph. Okay. So what's really going on, this is a stoichiometry matrix. It's got substrates and carriers, and then it's got two reactions. And so columns are reactions, rows are metabolites. And we take the whole thing and make it into a matrix, very sparse matrix. We're color-coding it for reversibility. So these two things are more or less, with little information, you can go from here. Substrate graph by, or you could make a reaction graph. And why is this bogus? So suppose this is